So this is the reality here in the occupied West Bank. These people behind me are protecting their town from settler attacks. There's no one else to do it.
Guys, we are here at the spot. There is suspicious movement by settlers. If you are able to come, come quickly, come.
Reports come in of a possible intrusion by a few settlers from the other side of the hill. Some volunteers spread out in the dark. They say it is dangerous as most settlers are armed.
We read via the chat groups that there were some settlers in between the houses. So the folks from the protection committees rushed out to protect those houses.
Palestinian police are not allowed to operate here unless coordinated with the Israeli military. The town lies in so-called areas B and C, which are under shared or full control of the Israeli military. Videos provided by the volunteers show some of the settler attacks in the area in recent weeks. This volunteer tells us they are the Palestinians' last defense. The Israeli police and army side with the settlers, allowing them to act with no accountability.
Ben-Gavir and Smotrich are trapped, the two most extremist, fanatical, and openly genocidal ministers in Israel's history have found themselves completely cornered by the very country that, over a century ago, set the stage for the catastrophe that has befallen the Palestinian people. The United Kingdom, the architect of the Balfour Declaration, the power that handed over Palestinian land to European settlers under the guise of a mandate, has finally, after decades of complicity, decades of turning a blind eye, decades of enabling the slow-motion, ethnic cleansing of an entire nation, decided to live up to its responsibilities. For the first time in this bloody chapter of history, a Western democracy has taken a tangible, concrete step to protect the oppressed indigenous population of Palestine from a settler colonial project that has spiraled into outright genocide in Gaza and is now metastasizing with unprecedented violence in the West Bank. And you can see the panic, the sheer unadulterated terror in the eyes of these architects of apartheid as they realize the game has changed. Britain, alongside a coalition of 12 nations, including France, Canada, Spain, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Ireland, Norway, Poland, Portugal, and Sweden, has announced a sweeping ban on trade and goods produced in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. This is not just a diplomatic slap on the wrist. This is an economic blockade against the very infrastructure of occupation. British Foreign Secretary Ed Miliband didn't mince words. He stood in Parliament and accused settler terrorists of carrying out ethnic cleansing, stating that houses are being bulldozed, roads and public infrastructure destroyed, and families displaced from their homes. He expressed a deep sense of shame about what has unfolded in Palestine under the eyes of the international community. This is a monumental shift. This is the colonial master finally acknowledging the monster it created and attempting to slam the brakes on a runaway train of destruction. And the reaction from the occupation's far-right government has been nothing short of hysterical. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich called for the immediate expulsion of the British ambassador, accusing the UK of having an anti-Semitic government and declaring the British mandate in the land of Israel is over. National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, in a fit of delusional whataboutism, urged the occupation government to impose sanctions on Britain for occupying the Falkland Islands and to recognize Argentine sovereignty over them. This is the tantrum of a toddler who has had his favorite toy taken away, except the toy is stolen Palestinian land, and the tantrum is a threat to international law. Now, before we go any further, I need to ask you something. If you're watching this and you believe in justice, if you believe that the truth must be told, no matter how uncomfortable it is for the powers that be, hit that like button. Share this video with everyone you know. Drop a comment, even if it's just a dot, to tell the algorithm that real people are watching real journalism. And most importantly, if you haven't already, subscribe to this channel. Now, let's get into the meat of this story, because trust me, this is just the beginning.
Mr. Speaker, Madam Deputy Speaker, at the time of the Oslo Peace Accords in 1993, around 270,000 settlers lived in the occupied Palestinian territories. Today it is some 770,000. More settlements have been approved under the 4 years of this Israeli government than in the previous 20 years. Let us spell out what this has meant for Palestinian communities. Houses bulldozed, roads and public infrastructure destroyed, families displaced from their homes, community by community, family by family, person by person. Madam Deputy Speaker, 65 Palestinian communities completely expelled since 2023. A total of over 4,000 Palestinians evicted from their homes due to settler violence and state actions. And in August, the crossing of a long-standing red line, the issuing of E1 tenders for over 1,200 homes. Madam Deputy Speaker, I visited a community in the area covered by E1 in 2014. The Bedouin communities I met in Khan al-Ahmar had lived on that land for generations. E1 proposals would evict them and place settlements directly between East Jerusalem and the West Bank, cutting through the heart of Palestine. Yep. Let's be absolutely clear what this means. The creation of a set of facts on the ground to make the two-state solution unviable. Yeah. And on top of official state policy, settler terrorism is rampant. The UN reports an average of 6 violent settler attacks against Palestinians per day this year. Per day, the highest on record. Take one example. In Al-Mughayir, 20 miles north of Jerusalem, settlers have encircled the village and mounted a campaign of intimidation, largely under the protection of the Israeli military. Families in the village are increasingly cut off from accessing their land, squeezed into ever smaller areas, and have olive trees uprooted and livestock stolen. In the same community just last week, 2 teenagers were shot when settlers entered the village under police and military escort. Both died before reaching hospital. Madam Deputy Speaker, 5 teenagers have now been killed from their school this year. Ehud Olmert, the former Israeli Prime Minister, has described what is happening as, I quote, a violent and criminal effort to ethnically cleanse territories in the West Bank. The former Minister of Health and retired Brigadier General from the IDF, Ephraim Sneh, has said, and I quote again, this is ethnic cleansing, pure, to put it simply. Madam Deputy Speaker, ethnic cleansing is defined by the UN as a purposeful policy designed by one ethnic or religious group to remove by violent and terror-inspiring means the civilian population of another ethnic or religious group from certain geographic areas. The British government agrees that there is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in areas of the West Bank perpetrated by settler terrorists. And all too often, the Israeli government has turned a blind eye to this, and worse, members of it have made statements and taken actions to support the forced displacement of Palestinians. Now, Madam Deputy Speaker, I recognise the gravity of saying this, but the truth is, the least the people who face such suffering deserve, and it should be the prelude to justice. Yep. Now, for a long time, the British government has rightly said settlements are illegal, but we have remained silent on the question of the legality of the occupation as a whole, which in 2024 the International Court of Justice concluded was unlawful. Today I announce that the official view of the British government is that the occupation is unlawful. Yeah. Because of Israel's entrenchment of its control, its intention to extend permanent sovereignty, and its expansionist agenda via illegal settlements. Madam Deputy Speaker, our position is not just an overdue statement of reality. The government believes the unlawfulness of the occupation should be reflected in the economic relationships we choose to have with the occupied territories. Yeah. I do not believe the British people want us supporting the occupation by accepting products from settlements in our shops and supermarkets. So I can announce today that we will introduce an import ban on goods from illegal settlements in the occupied territories. Yeah. To do so, we will introduce a new comprehensive sanctions regime, working with my right honourable friend, the Business Secretary, with appropriate religious exemptions. And as part of this regime, we will go further. We will take action against specific companies and individuals who provide services such as construction, infrastructure, financing, or real estate for settlement expansion. Yeah. So to those who finance or facilitate illegal settlements, let me say this. you will face the full force of UK sanctions.
Yeah.
Settlements are illegal. They should not be promoted in our country. Earlier this year, Madam Deputy Speaker, shamefully, just a few miles from here, we saw an expo advertising illegal settlement land. We must and we will ensure this never happens again. Yeah. So we will ban the advertising in the UK of illegal settlements.
Yeah.
The sanctions regime will target illegal settlements and settlement expansion, not Israel. We will continue to support important and valued trade with Green Line Israel, precisely because we support the two-state solution, including security and prosperity for Israel. For this reason, I wholeheartedly oppose the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions or BDS campaign. The legislation I have announced today will be in place within 6 to 9 months, and we will also take more immediate steps. Today we are sanctioning a further set of extremist settlers who have supported or incited acts of violence against Palestinian communities. And I can also announce that we are extending the existing global human rights regime such that it will enable swifter action to deter settlement expansion, including, crucially, seeking to prevent the development of E1. I also want to address the question of arms sales. We've already suspended over 30 arms licenses used by the IDF in Gaza. That suspension remains fully in place. We will now also refuse all license applications for arms and other exports that materially contribute to the occupation, in effect, a double lock against arms sales. This means the ban on such exports will now remain in place as long as the occupation persists. Madam Deputy Speaker, to advance the two-state solution, we also need viable and effective Palestinian governance. So I urge the Palestinian Authority to accelerate reform, and I urge Israel to lift its withholding of revenues that is, frankly, financially crippling the provision of essential services in the West Bank. The set of measures I have announced represents a clear message to the Government of Israel, to the Palestinians in the occupied territories, and to the world that we will not acquiesce in the destruction of the two-state solution. I turn now to Gaza. The horror of October the 7th appalled the world and had terrible echoes of the centuries of persecution of the Jewish people. Men, women, children and babies killed, mutilated and tortured by Hamas terrorists. People murdered while seeking to protect their families. Young people massacred at a music festival. People abducted from their homes. As the 20-point peace plan for Gaza sets out, this is one of many reasons Hamas can play no role in the future governance of Gaza. It must decommission its weapons and must dismantle its terrorist infrastructure.
Yeah.
Israel has the right not to live in fear of vile terrorism, and the Israeli state has the right to protect its people and defend its territory. But, Madam Deputy Speaker, that cannot justify what has happened in Gaza. Over 70,000 people have been killed, at least 20,000 of them children. 20,000 children. The vast majority of the population is now displaced. Nearly 2 million people who are now penned into just one-third of the territory. Life-saving humanitarian aid and access has been routinely blocked. Hospitals and clinics have been destroyed. Over 60% of homes are in ruins. Madam Deputy Speaker, international humanitarian law imposes clear rules for states fighting wars, including to ensure access to food and medical supplies, to avoid mass displacement of civilians, and to avoid the targeting of civilians. Serious and international violations of this law, if proven, amount to war crimes. What has occurred, including the actions of the IDF, have been examined in depth by a number of organisations, including the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry. The conclusions of these reports represent increasing evidence that war crimes appear to have been committed, and we support legal processes to determine this. On the question of genocide, the UK has always supported full, robust and fair judicial processes to consider allegations, with final determinations made by competent courts before the British government reaches a conclusion. This has been the case for all of the genocides since the 1948 Genocide Convention: Rwanda, Srebrenica, Cambodia, and acts against the Yazidi people. That will remain our policy. It is right this issue has been brought before the ICJ, and I want to make it clear that we support the court in coming to its determination.
The significance of this moment cannot be overstated. You have to understand the history. The United Kingdom is not just another country imposing sanctions. Britain is the original sin. In 1917, the British government issued the Balfour Declaration, a letter from Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour to Lord Rothschild that promised a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. At the time, Palestine was still formally part of the Ottoman Empire. The British had no legal right, no moral authority, no business making promises about land that belonged to the indigenous Palestinian population that had lived there for centuries. They did it anyway, because that's what empires do. They carve up the world to suit their interests, completely disregarding the lives of the people who actually live there. In 1922, the League of Nations officially designated Britain as the mandatory power in Palestine, and the mandate was specifically and openly designed to facilitate the establishment of that Jewish national home. This mandate was a death sentence for Palestinian self-determination. It paved the way for massive Jewish immigration from Europe, which in turn brought explicit opposition from the indigenous communities who saw their land being systematically taken from them. This set the stage for the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. When the occupation state was declared on May 15, 1948, Zionist forces, backed by the British and American governments, embarked on a campaign of ethnic cleansing that forcibly displaced at least 750,000 Palestinians out of a population of 1.4 million. They were expelled from their homes at gunpoint, civilians were massacred, and hundreds of Palestinian villages were deliberately destroyed. The Nakba is not a historical event that ended in 1948. It is an ongoing process of expropriation, dispossession, and displacement that continues to this day. The occupation state denies the Nakba ever happened, even as it openly calls for a second one, and we are watching that second Nakba unfold in real time in Gaza and the West Bank. The international community, led by the United States, has enabled this for over seven decades. The UK, as the original architect, bears a special, unique, and heavy burden of guilt. And now, finally, the UK is taking a stand, not out of the goodness of its heart, but because the situation has become so extreme, so undeniably genocidal, that even the most cynical Western politicians can no longer pretend they don't see it. Now, let's talk about the architects of this terror. Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. These are not just politicians with extreme views. These are war criminals operating with impunity, and they have openly and proudly called for crimes against humanity. Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, declared in May that Gaza will be entirely destroyed and that its civilian population would start to leave in great numbers to third countries. Remarks that have been widely decried by legal experts as advocating ethnic cleansing. He has openly defended the strangling of Gaza and treated starvation as a tool of policy. He has called for the establishment of buffer zones around settlements in the West Bank and preventing Palestinians from approaching them. He has stated there's no such thing as a Palestinian people. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister, has called for killing 30 to 40 Palestinians in Gaza every night, saying that some Palestinians are not worthy of life and are not even people. The person responsible for the security of an entire population is openly calling for a nightly slaughter quota. These are the men who are now trapped in Britain, figuratively speaking. They have been sanctioned by the UK before, and now the UK is leading a global coalition to cut off the economic lifeblood of their illegal enterprise. Their furious, childish outbursts calling to expel the ambassador and recognize Argentine sovereignty over the Falklands are the desperate screams of cornered predators who know their reign of terror is being challenged. But even more damning than the actions of these two ministers is the revelation about the man at the top of this pyramid of blood, war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu. A new book, Kidnapped, 843 Days of Abandonment, by journalists Shlomi Eldar and Ruth Yuval, based on interviews with dozens of sources, including senior officials, has exposed the most shocking, unforgivable act of negligence and calculated malice. According to a Haaretz investigation citing the book some 10 days before the October 7, 2023 attack, the leader of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed, personally warned Netanyahu that Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar was planning a major offensive move that would lead to bloodshed, unsettle the region, and potentially harm the Abraham Accords. The warning was delivered during a 45-minute phone call, and Bin Zayed urged Netanyahu to address the wider sources of instability, including the economic situation in Gaza and rising tensions in the West Bank. a Palestinian advisor to the Emirati president, who had direct knowledge of the conversation, confirmed that bin Zayed was surprised by Netanyahu's response, as he did not appear alarmed. Netanyahu told bin Zayed that he believed Hamas was preparing to act in the West Bank and assured him that Israel was ready to respond to any scenario. But here's the kicker. Netanyahu did absolutely nothing with this information. He did not update his security leaders. He did not inform the heads of his defense establishment, including the Shin Bet and Mossad heads and the IDF chief of staff. He dismissed the warning and chose to keep quiet. Netanyahu's office has denied the call and the warning ever took place, but the evidence is overwhelming. The Haaretz report is based on interviews with dozens of sources and internal documents. The Emirati president later discussed the warning with CIA director William J. Burns, describing his concern that something there is about to explode. Egypt's intelligence chief also separately warned Netanyahu around the same period about something unusual, a terrifying operation that Hamas was preparing. Netanyahu reportedly responded to the Egyptian warning by saying, "In Gaza, we are in the picture. We are in control. Our problem is with the West Bank, and that's where we are also diverting forces." The only logical conclusion, and I say this with absolute fury, is that Netanyahu knew. He knew a catastrophic attack was imminent, and he chose to let it happen. He chose to sacrifice his own citizens, the settlers, everyone, to use it as a pretext to destroy Gaza. This was not a failure of intelligence, this was a failure of leadership, a deliberate act of sabotage to justify an expansionist war and to consolidate his own political power. He sat on a warning that could have saved thousands of lives, and he did nothing. And when the attack finally happened, his response was inexcusably sluggish. At 6:29, on the morning of October 7th, 2023, Netanyahu was immediately told that Hamas-led terrorists were attacking. He took at least 2 hours to leave his Caesarea home and head to the IDF's Kiryat military headquarters in Tel Aviv. He did not contact the IDF chief of staff Herzi Halevi or Shin Bet head Ronen Bar in that time, or en route to the Kiryat. He did not hold his first situational assessment at military headquarters until 9:55 a.m. Only then did he order a full IDF mobilization and give orders that the border be hermetically sealed. By then, it was far too late. This man is not a leader. He is a war criminal who must face justice. If you are as outraged as I am, if you believe that the Palestinian people deserve to live in freedom and dignity, then do something. Share this video. Talk to your friends and family. Educate yourself and others about the history of this conflict. And most importantly, subscribe to this channel. We will continue to bring you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, no matter how uncomfortable it is for the powers that be. We are your voice, we are your weapon, and together we will fight for justice, for Palestine, and for a world free from oppression. Thank you for watching, and as always, stay informed, stay angry, and stay engaged. The fight is far from over, but we are winning. I'll see you in the next one.